Welcome to the Being Curious Show. I'm Brian Mariani, founder of No Shift Own.
And I'm Kelly Wagner, publisher of Edge Magazine. Our show is about curiously connecting teachers and seekers on a wide range of topics in a safe space. Few topics will be off limits, and we have some amazing guests to share with you.
Our intention is that our conversations will spark your own curiosity to create a life that lights you up and inspires you to be kind, thoughtful, open-minded to yourself and others.
We are on AM 950, Sundays at 2 p.m. and all podcast platforms. So, Brian, what are you curious about today?
Well, Kelly, we're back in studio. We're curious. We're ready to rock and roll. The spring is in the air. Technically, at this moment in time, spring is in the air.
Yeah.
Even in a place like Minnesota.
Did you go for your run? Did you go for your run yesterday?
Of course I went for my run.
Okay. We were talking about how you were going to go from the inside workout regimen to the outside workout regimen, which is really big when you live in the Northeast, the Midwest, right? And the birds are out. I think it was Sienna Miller, who is an actress from the UK, talking about living in London. And she's like, we earn our springs. And I'm like, whoa, that's just not there. It's here. We earn our springs. We are so grateful for having the windows open and hearing the birds. I know that sounds like anybody that lives in warm weather, they're like, they need to just stop dragging on. But we are grateful. We are grateful for this time of year.
We are so grateful. When you live through a Boston winter or a Minneapolis winter, you relish these moments of getting out into the spring weather.
Absolutely.
We hope that you take us with you, whether you're running or walking. Of course, you can listen to us on any of the podcast platforms. And we love that you take these conversations into your life, into your workouts. We're very, very grateful.
So can I tell a little story?
Yeah, go, please.
I got recognized the other day.
No way.
Someone heard my voice and they're like, you're Kelly from the Being Curious show. And I was like, oh my gosh. And of course I'm like at Costco, no makeup, hair up, looking just awesome.
There you are.
I was. Okay, Mr. Brian, we have a very special guest today. Who is our guest?
Here's the thing. I think we're both in a really, really good mood. I think people can feel the energy's high because we are with the one and only Dr. Stephen G. Post.
Woohoo!
And this is what he does. He has a lifetime of literally bringing happiness and just good vibes out into the world. He is a multiple published author. He's really recognized internationally. In specifically his work around deeply forgetful people, which is this wonderful area that a lot of people have to deal with. And he's done what's really significant about his work is that he's done a lot with funding and working with scientific studies in all of these areas, especially around Alzheimer's. And more than anything, he is a good, good person. And it resonates from just his voice and his character and his smile and everything that you see online. So Dr. Post, welcome to our show. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Kelly. It's a pleasure.
Awesome. Well, we're really excited to dive in and get into this conversation. And there's a question that we love to ask kind of right up front. And I kind of already know some of the answer to this question, but I'd love for our audience to know. You mentioned in some of your work, there was this experience, or I'll call it a dream, that you had back in high school that really kind of got you started on this path. And so if you could walk us back to that moment, we'd all love to hear that story.
Look at that laugh and those eyes and that sparkle. And I'm trying my darndest to not see my pictures.
No pictures yet.
No pictures yet.
Let Dr. Post go.
Go for it.
Well, you know, you could start in a lot of different places. You know, I've been teaching in medical schools and doing all kinds of things with my life. I have a wonderful family. But it's a strange tale that all of this really began when I was a kid and I had a dream. And I had a favorite quote from Eleanor Roosevelt, "The future belongs to those who believe in the beauty of their dreams." And so I was a 15-year-old kid at a high school in New Hampshire, where, by the way, George and Charlie Pillsbury went to school. I ran on the same cross country team as George, and it was an Episcopal school, and I was just definitely not the everyday person there. I was always reading scriptures from all the religions of the world. I was walking through nature, and I was cherishing it and feeling the gift of the universe around us. I was that kind of a spacey kid, I suppose. And we all had chapel every single morning. So one morning I was waking up, and I had this incredible dream of a road that was headed toward the west. It was hard to actually see more than a foot in front of me because it was filled with mist. And then to my left, I heard a scratching, and I squinted, and I saw a blonde-haired youth who looked like he was about to jump off some kind of a ledge. And then all of a sudden, a blue angel came into my view, not a winged angel, just the feminine face of an angel. And she said very empathically, with a kind of gentle curiosity, if you save him, you too shall live. And then she alighted, and all of the mist and cloud evaporated, and it was a bright, sunny day. And I was struck by that. So I told my friends, and we had a sacred studies class. People like Gary Trudeau and all kinds of folks were in there. And I told people this story. And what was interesting about it is that it repeated itself five times over the course of the year. And eventually, I was referred to as the Blue Angel Dreamer. And my teacher, who was an Episcopal priest, Rod Wells, took us down to Yale Divinity School, and there was a class there on adolescent spirituality. And, you know, a lot of times you listeners, you know, your kids can have incredibly intuitive experiences. And it's so easy to just write that off as silliness. But a lot of times it's very deep and very meaningful. And for me, this was. So I gave this presentation in front of this class of Yale Divinity School students. And I was, at the time, I was 16. And I told them about the dream. And then they asked me questions. So what did you think about this? Did it make you worry about yourself? Were you feeling ill? How was your mental health? You know, I said no problems. You know, I'm just an everyday guy, but it did shape me a little bit. And you know, I took Emerson for seriously. For example, most people just read Emerson, but I actually took him seriously because of his idea of the over mind, the one mind, that we're all sort of connected in this oneness of consciousness, which at that time, you know, wasn't a very popular idea. Now it actually is. And so, you know, school went on, and I decided I wasn't going to go to Swarthmore. I actually had an argument with my mom and dad after my senior year because I wanted to tutor in the Bronx, and they thought it was too dangerous. So we really argued this out for 3 or 4 days. And my dad, who worked in retail, knew all the manufacturers of lamps and furniture around New York. And so he said, well, I can help you out. I'll get you another job. I said, what would that be? You can work in Bill DeBono's lampshade factory. Okay. So I spent about 2 weeks working in between two huge, heavily smoking Italian ladies. And I was basically cutting cardboard for lampshades. And one Friday night, my dad had a secondhand gray Mercedes 190 that was in bad shape. And it's actually in the pictures in the book, God and Love on Route 80. And so one night I just drove this thing out east on Long Island to West Hampton Beach. And about 11 at night, I said to my friends who I knew from high school, I'm going west. I'm going to follow my dream. It was a push because things weren't so good at home, but it was a pull because the dream was headed to the west. So I drove west. I drove through New York City. I drove over the George Washington Bridge for the first time in my life. And there were two signs, Brian. One said 95 South. That wasn't in the dream. But the other said 80 West. So I got on 80 West and I drove. And about 5 in the morning, I was at the Lewisburg exit, 215 on Route 80. And I was just about to turn around. I was going to turn around and go home, and my reputation would be saved. But lo and behold, this car had a generator. And when the generator went, the whole car went. There was no current anyplace. So I was able to get over to the side of the road. And here I was in the middle of Pennsylvania. There's no pay phones. No one had cell phones or anything. So all I could do was I reached into the glove compartment. I pulled out a piece of paper. And I wrote in pencil, this lives in infamy in my family legacy, to the Pennsylvania State Police, please return this car to Henry A.V. Post, 44 Davidson Lane, West Islip, New York, 516-669-5655, from his son, Stephen, who no longer works in the lampshade factory. And then this big truck came by, guy pulled over, I had my thumb out, I got in there with my guitar and a few other items, and that was how it all began. But anyway, I wound up in my cousin George Lamont's. I don't know if you heard of Lamont Gloves. That was George. George was a Vietnam vet, and he was starting to make gloves, and he lived in the Mission District of San Francisco on Chenery Street. He was a North Carolina Chapel Hill grad in Chinese studies, and he was older than me. He's a great guy. And I found his place, and I knew 16 Chenery Street. And so I said, George, it's me, your cousin Stevie. Can I sleep on your floor for the summer? And, of course, he said, yeah, because he was part of that Vietnam vet subculture, you know. And so there was a Nichiren Shosho Buddhist temple on the corner of Market and Chenery. And that's where I learned to chant Nam-myoho-renge-kyo, which means, you know, one mind, the universe, devotion to kindness. And I didn't actually spend much time there, but enough to get the idea. And lo and behold, I was playing classical guitar in Hispanic restaurants all around the Mission area. So what happened was I drew a really, really bad number in the draft, and I called Reed College in Portland, Oregon, where I had been accepted, you know, a year ago or so, but I told them I wouldn't go. And I said, look, I really need a break, because I don't want to go over to Vietnam and, you know, I'm just be caught up in that terrible situation. So they said they'd make a spot for me. And so one morning in the second week of September, I'm in front of the Nam-myoho-renge Nichiren Shosho Buddhist temple. And there's George and an old Japanese American named Gus. And they gave me a gahonzon, which is a scroll. And, you know, it's about 2-3 feet long. And it's got all kinds of interesting symbols, like kindness is a heart. And in Japanese script, the word for unkind is a heart with a line through it. So there are all kinds of interesting symbols that they showed me. And it was early in the morning. So I said goodbye, put this thing in my backpack, and I took off on the Market Street bus, and I got to Golden Gate Park. I walked across the park, which is a pretty long walk, and then I walked up those rocks, and I got on the Golden Gate Bridge, and I couldn't see more than, you know, really an inch, 5 inches in front of me. The fog was so thick. It was so thick and heavy. And I walked to the middle of that big arch, and there to the left I heard this scratching sound, and I didn't quite know what it was, but I looked at it, and there was a guy with long, dirty blonde hair who was leaning off the Golden Gate Bridge, and it looked like he was about to jump. And I said to him, I really hope you don't plan to jump. And then he started screaming. He was cussing at me. He actually quoted Macbeth, you know, life is empty nothingness. He was a, you know, thoughtful kid. And I said, I know that, and it sounds more real when you're out there about to jump off a bridge than it did when we were up at St. Paul's in New Hampshire in Memorial Hall playing that particular drama. And I said, look, I want you to just pause, and I'm going to tell you how I got here. And I told the kid about my dream. And I told him about how I went up to or down to Yale from Concord, New Hampshire to New Haven, Yale Divinity School, and how I had a fight with my parents. And I drove out to West Hampton Beach, and then I took the car, and I just kept going. And then the generator, I told him everything. And I told him about the note that I wrote to the Pennsylvania police. And I said, I don't know if you can believe this, but I feel as though, given that dream, that I'm supposed to be here talking with you right now. And I know that was a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, when I had that dream, and it was 3,000 miles away. But somehow or another, I feel like, and it's, you know, it's crazy, but I think I was supposed to be here and talk with you. And then he just cussed and said, you're crazy. And I said, yeah, but I'm not out there about to jump.
Okay, you have to pause. Hold on one moment because we've got to go to our next segment and we are going to come right back and we're going to continue this beautiful, because I'm like, wait a sec, I want to know about this guy. Being curious, Kelly and Brian and Kelly here with Dr. Post. We'll see you in a moment. Discover Strains of the Earth, your go-to destination for all things holistic. This family-owned dispensary in Jordan and Carver offers a curated collection of high-quality THC products such as seltzers, edibles, tinctures, and more. Our knowledgeable staff members can guide you with expert recommendations and responsible usage tips. Explore the selection at strainsoftheearth.com and enjoy convenient delivery right to your home. Strains of the Earth, saving the world with cannabis.
Are you ready to dive into a world of exploration, enlightenment, and higher consciousness? The Edge Magazine media platform is your ultimate one-stop shop for all things curious. They're a vibrant community of seekers and teachers passionate about sharing their gifts and abilities to help the collective explore, develop, and understand their journey towards higher consciousness. EdgeMagazine.net receives over 13,000 viewers each month, boasting unique articles, enlightening forecasts, and insightful book reviews. Over 16,000 copies of the Edge Magazine are printed every other month and distributed to over 600 locations across the Midwest. Experience a world of opportunities with Edge Magazine. Unleash exposure through enticing print and online ads, Edge Partner Directory membership, and community calendar listings. Share your expertise in radio and multimedia interviews, connecting with their diverse community. Join their vibrant events, connect with like-minded individuals, and share your gifts here, there, and everywhere. That's edgemagazine.net.
Can you harm yourself using energy medicine? The answer is yes. Gail Lynn, the creator of the Harmonic Egg products for commercial and home use, has been involved in the field of energy medicine for the past 15 years. In her experience, Gail has witnessed cases where people have faced negative consequences due to improper use of energy medicine. Some individuals did not allow the sessions to integrate properly or expose their bodies to beneficial energies for extended periods, leading to harmful effects. This can cause the body to go into defense, flight, or fight mode, creating confusion within the body despite the positive nature of the energy. There's also the potential risk of hiring a wounded healer who may unintentionally hurt their clients. For these reasons and more, she's committed to educating people around the safe and appropriate use of energy medicine. For those interested in learning more, Gail provides videos, articles, books, and other resources at harmonicegg.com. Contact her directly at info@harmonicegg.com to find out more about safe and effective energy healing products and services. SOS Holistic Healing Center, Minot's finest crystal store, and so much more. Come in and feel the amazing holistic well-being energy at Minot's SOS Holistic Healing Center, located at 420 20th Avenue Southeast, Suite 2 in Minot, North Dakota. We're your source for all things metaphysical and holistic. Here you'll find a large array of treasures, including crystals, oracle and tarot cards, handcrafted jewelry, essential oils, sage and incense, herbal teas and candles, singing bowls, tuning forks, natural soaps, healthcare products, and so much more. We're open Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m., Saturdays from 11 to 4. And one Saturday each month, you can experience Practitioner's Day, where we may include energy healing sessions, card readings, intuitive and psychic readings, and more. We also host special events in our large gathering room and hold monthly meetings with like-minded people. Stop in and see what resonates with you. Embark on a journey of holistic and spirituality with SOS Holistic Healing Center, where harmony and discovery unite. Visit us today and embrace the magic that awaits. Oh my gosh, you guys are back.
We're back.
Woohoo, woohoo. Okay.
Speaking of being on the edge of our seat, the last thing we heard, someone was literally on a ledge. As are all of we. Dr. Post, please continue.
Okay, so you're on the bridge. You're talking to the blonde guy that you saw in the dream. He's cussing at you. Go for it.
Yeah, so I'm right in the, that's the middle, you know, it's one big span. I'm right in the middle of the bridge on the left side. And we were having this back and forth. And I was telling him, you know, I think I'm here for a reason. And so I don't want you to jump. I want to talk with you. And I was very kind of, you know, gently curious in my tone. So so I said, look, if you step over this railing and come over where I am, I was on the pedestrian path, I'm going to give you something that's going to change your luck. You know, sometimes Buddhism is like that. So I said, I've got something in my backpack, which I just got an hour ago, and it's called a Gahon Zone. I bet you don't even know what that is. So I pulled this thing out. I opened up the scroll, and he was really curious. He, you know, he looked at it, squinted it, and you know, the mist was getting a little thinner, and he actually came across, and I told him what some of the symbols meant, you know, like one mind, infinite love, those kinds of things, and I said, look, you can have this, and it's going to make your life go much, much better. You can have this. What's your name? His name was Harry. You can have this, and you've got to do one thing, though. You've got to take this note, and I wrote him a note to my cousin George Lamont, 16 Chenery Street in the Mission District. Dear cousin George, this is Harry. Please let him sleep on your floor just where I slept and take care of him, and let's see how it goes. And so Harry actually did that. He took the Gahon Zone. And he went to Cousin George's. I didn't know that at the time, but I had no idea where he would go, but I hoped he would. And George was a very good psychologist, a good counselor. And so Harry eventually, I didn't go back. I did not go back to the Mission District until Thanksgiving, November, because I actually hitchhiked up to Reed College from there in Oregon. But Harry... married the girlfriend I was spending time with that summer. And sorry. Okay. And
that's and they awesome. Were
the gift yeah. that keeps on giving.
You just set him up.
I set him up for life. And they went back to North Carolina. And I'm not going to go into the details, but if you read God and Love on Route 80, a lot of it's there. So I was shocked because here it is. I had a dream that 2 years earlier, 3,000 miles away. And here was a kid who looked pretty much the same as the one in my dream. And I was stunned. And he was on a ledge and I didn't know it would be a bridge, but he's about to jump. And somehow just by calming him down, you know, and talking about this crazy thing, he came around. And so I hitchhiked up to Reed College that morning. As soon as I got on the downside of the bridge, the north side of the bridge, suddenly the sun started shining. All the morning mist was gone, and I could see clearly, it seemed like for miles. And I just knew that somehow or another, you know, human beings are more cherished and connected, and there's more oneness than we sometimes realize. And if we just kind of pause and be mindful and get out of our constant chronological pushing from point A to point B, just kind of take the time to breathe deep and realize that a lot of things happen. I mean, you know, people call this synchronicity, when, you know, the right person at the right time in the most uncanny way, and there's no way you can explain it. It's totally bizarre, but that's what happened there. So I got up to Reed College, and just to finish the story real quickly, so, you know, the second thing that the angel said was, if you save him, you too shall live. Well, I guess you could say I'd saved the kid. And but I wasn't sure what it meant that you too shall live. So now I was up there in the days of Jobs, and we were all taking calligraphy. That was the fad. And we were taking courses like Alchemy 101. You know, quantum physics and the history of medieval science.
Amazing.
Jobs was sleeping on my floor, reading the autobiography of a yogi, that kind of stuff. And so...
Wait. Did you just say Jobs was sleeping on your floor?
Yeah. Jobs was a Reed College kid. And Robert Bly, who was a Minneapolis poet, he was the poet in residence. So I signed up for his class, and there were just 12 of us sitting on the floor, and he was incredible. He's one of the great poets of American history. And so it was that kind of an era. But anyway, it's late January, and it doesn't snow in Oregon, but it gets rainy and cold. And I'm sitting in the coffee shop with a bunch of young kids. I was, at the time, I was 17, I guess, at that point. And this guy, it's like 9 o'clock. This guy comes bounding through the front door to the coffee shop. He says, "My name's Andy. I've got a motorcycle, the fastest motorcycle in the world. And who wants to go for a ride?" Well, in my complete lacking of any sort of foresight, I said, "I'll do it." And I went out there, and he was lit up, and he was wearing a black jacket, and, you know, he looked a little crazed. No one had ever seen him before. So I jumped on the back of his motorcycle, and he took off, and he hit like, you know, 120 miles an hour in just a couple of minutes. And he went through every red light, every stop sign, and he was slip sliding along because it wasn't snowy, but it was icy. And I was completely shocked. I thought I wouldn't survive. And he went south on the Pacific Coast Highway for about an hour. And I was crying. At a certain point, I was actually crying. I was begging him to let me off this bike. And he was screaming in this cold rain that was battering down along his face. And finally, he just did this sort of Evel Knievel U-turn on the Midway. And he actually, still going now, hit 120. He dropped me off exactly where he picked me up in front of the Reed College coffee shop. And it's 11 o'clock. So it's 2 o'clock in New York. And I'm like wobbling. I could hardly walk. And I wobbled over this bridge over a ravine, and I got to Ackerman Dormitory where I was living. And I never picked up the payphone. They had payphones. Most people don't know what that is now. But anyway, they had payphones. And I never picked it up. But as I was walking across the threshold of the common room at the entrance, I felt the phone rang just as I walked by it, it rang. And I just felt somehow, I didn't see anything, but, you know, I don't drink. Anything like that. But I just felt sort of pushed intuitively to pick up the phone. And I picked it up and I said, "Hello." And it was my mom.
I'm sorry.
And she said, "Oh my God, you're alive." And I said, "Yeah, I'm alive, but barely." And she said, well, she'd woken up from her sleep. And now, mind you, it's 2 a.m. in New York. And so it's 3,000 miles away. And she said, "I just had this terrible fear and premonition that you were dead. And I'm sweating. And Henry..." who got my letter from Pennsylvania, Henry A.B. Post, is by my side, and we're wondering if you're alive. And I said, "Yeah, I'm alive, but just barely." And I explained to her what had happened. And then that was where our relationship really blossomed, because we realized that we were both open-minded about this sense of being more deeply connected and cherished, and that somehow there's something about a mother's love for a child that can help this connection unfold, you know. And it's interesting how many times you read that in the literature. So that was my dream. If you save him, you too shall live. So somehow or another, I got through that horrendous night, and I never forgot it. In the book, there was a picture that my mother, she was an abstract expressionist painter. There's a picture of a blue angel dream that my mother actually painted. So that's how I got started. I'm sorry to go on so long.
That was a great story, though. Like, wow.
That
okay,
was a great story.
How did your mom know to call that payphone?
Yeah, well, I gave her the number out of respect. You know, I
got it.
When I got to Reed, this will kill you. So the first night I was there, I didn't know I was on the Reed College campus, but there was a big white plastic blow up tent with colors being projected and a lot of noise. And I walked up to the first guy I saw, who was about 5'10", burly, red hair, you know, shooting out like this. And um, he He had a can of Rheingold in one hand and a cigar-like entity in the other. We don't know exactly what was in that. And I said to him, "Sir," being a St. Paul's graduate, "is this Reed College?" And he breathed in my face, which was toxic for sure. And he said, "Yeah, little buddy." And he revealed an American flag permanently ensconced in his upper right front tooth. And then I walked up to the kid my age, and I said, "So who's that?" Now I know him at Reed College, but who's that? So that was Ken Kesey. And my mother, he was up there in the Willamette River Valley of Oregon writing his second book, Sometimes the Great Notion, which is a very good book. And they let him come to the Reed College campus once a year with his pranksters, and they had this kind of happening event. And so that night.
And that's your first day on campus.
First day on campus.
Yep, of course.
So I couldn't resist, because after all, I mean, I'd stolen my dad's car and all that stuff. So I called my mom and collect. And I said, "Mom, it's me. And here's my phone number. Here's the telephone, payphone." And I said, "Guess what? I made it to college." And she said, "Oh my God, that's great." And I said, "But the first person I met, not like the second or the third or the fourth, was Ken Kesey." And she had been reading Tom Wolfe's book about Kesey. And she was like shocked. There was nothing from her for like 3 or 4 minutes. And then she said breathlessly, "Stevie, are you okay?" And I said, "Mom, he had no influence on me whatsoever." And that was okay. That was it. But that's how she got the phone number. And again, I never picked up the phone. I don't think she called much, but she was in a state of such fear that night after I almost got killed on the highway. And somehow, as a mother, she knew. This talks about, you know, the power of love to go beyond time and place in some people's lives. And this is how the guy who discovered brainwaves, who was a British scientist, his daughter had a dream that his son had been killed on the battlefields in World War I. And that happened to be true. And so this gave him the idea that somehow there has to be something about our minds that's not just biological, that's somehow beyond that, that's mysterious. And so that's what was happening between my mother and myself at the time.
I kind of get when you were on the motorcycle, I kind of dialed into the story that you were sharing. There could have easily been a flip of a coin where you didn't get off that bike and your mom was dialing into maybe a, I don't want to say an alternate possibility or alternate, but she was, I mean, your connection with your mom just sounds beyond this world and just so beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was. And you know, she died in 2001, and I was at the time a full professor at Case Western School of Medicine in Cleveland. It's funny, I get from a dream as a 15-year-old to a, and I was teaching things like compassionate care and communication techniques for medical students, because that's really what we need in healthcare now, is better communication. And I loved it. And we lived in Shaker Heights, and my dad had died, and my mother actually came out there for the last 4 years of her life and lived in a condo, and we were pretty close, and it was intuitive, you know, it was an intuitive thing. She always loved art and symbols, and she used to read some of Carl Jung, and so we could connect on a lot of these things.
Have you connected with your parents since they've transitioned?
No, I have not. No, not that I'm aware of anyway. Now you never know, but I have not had that moment.
Have you had any signs or symbols or serendipity moments since they've transitioned?
Oh yeah, for sure. I know. For sure.
I just want to let you know. I know, okay. And I think it's beautiful.
We have 3 minutes, right?
We are down to a minute and a half for this segment.
So God in Love on Route 80 is just a story about 12 episodes of powerful synchronicity that occurred in my life. And they occurred all along Route 80. You know, I mean, I was in Cleveland. That's a Route 80 town. I was, I was in Chicago. You know, I spent most of my life on Route 80, east or west. And that's what it is. It's all about synchronicity on Route 80. So I think it's kind of a mystical highway. My daughter even went to Bucknell University, which is on Route 80 in Middle Pennsylvania.
Of course,
exactly. And when I would drop her off, I would drive by exactly the place where I left Dad's car.
And that's when you go like this and you say, thank you.
Well, I decided as a dad, I wasn't going to complain about some of her behaviors.
No. You got to let her be free. Okay, yeah, you guys, wrapping up segment two. I mean, oh my goodness, this is just sliding by. This is the Being Curious Show with Kelly and Brian, Brian and Kelly, and Dr. Stephen Post. We will be back in just a couple moments. Discover Strains of the Earth, your go-to destination for all things holistic. This family-owned dispensary in Jordan and Carver offers a curated collection of high-quality THC products such as seltzers, edibles, tinctures, and more. Our knowledgeable staff members can guide you with expert recommendations and responsible usage tips. Explore the selection at strainsoftheearth.com and enjoy convenient delivery right to your home. Strains of the Earth, saving the world with cannabis.
Are you ready to dive into a world of exploration, enlightenment, and higher consciousness? The Edge Magazine media platform is your ultimate one-stop shop for all things curious. They're a vibrant community of seekers and teachers passionate about sharing their gifts and abilities to help the collective explore, develop, and understand their journey towards higher consciousness. EdgeMagazine.net receives over 13,000 viewers each month, boasting unique articles, enlightening forecasts, and insightful book reviews. Over 16,000 copies of the Edge Magazine are printed every other month and distributed to over 600 locations across the Midwest. Experience a world of opportunities with Edge Magazine. Unleash exposure through enticing print and online ads, Edge Partner Directory membership, and community calendar listings. Share your expertise in radio and multimedia interviews, connecting with their diverse community. Join their vibrant events, connect with like-minded individuals, and share your gifts here, there, and everywhere. That's edgemagazine.net.
Can you harm yourself using energy medicine? The answer is yes. Gail Lynn, the creator of the Harmonic Egg products for commercial and home use, has been involved in the field of energy medicine for the past 15 years. In her experience, Gail has witnessed cases where people have faced negative consequences due to improper use of energy medicine. Some individuals did not allow the sessions to integrate properly or expose their bodies to beneficial energies for extended periods, leading to harmful effects. This can cause the body to go into defense, flight, or fight mode, creating confusion within the body despite the positive nature of the energy. There's also the potential risk of hiring a wounded healer who may unintentionally hurt their clients. For these reasons and more, she's committed to educating people around the safe and appropriate use of energy medicine. For those interested in learning more, Gail provides videos, articles, books, and other resources at harmonicegg.com. Contact her directly at info@harmonicegg.com to find out more about safe and effective energy healing products and services. SOS Holistic Healing Center, Minot's finest crystal store, and so much more. Come in and feel the amazing holistic well-being energy at Minot's SOS Holistic Healing Center, located at 420 20th Avenue Southeast, Suite 2 in Minot, North Dakota. We're your source for all things metaphysical and holistic. Here you'll find a large array of treasures, including crystals, oracle and tarot cards, handcrafted jewelry, essential oils, sage and incense, herbal teas and candles, singing bowls, tuning forks, natural soaps, healthcare products, and so much more. We're open Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m., Saturdays from 11 to 4. And one Saturday each month, you can experience Practitioner's Day, where we may include energy healing sessions, card readings, intuitive and psychic readings, and more. We also host special events in our large gathering room and hold monthly meetings with like-minded people. Stop in and see what resonates with you. Embark on a journey of holistic and spirituality with SOS Holistic Healing Center, where harmony and discovery unite. Visit us today and embrace the magic that awaits.
All right, we are back with Dr. Stephen Post. Kelly, this has been an amazing experience to just hear this story from you, Dr. Post. It's a beautiful story, and I really hope that people listen all the way through. I mean, you could certainly take breaks, but really the congruency of the story has so much power. You know, as I was listening, what kept coming to me was, you know, that famous quote, that famous philosophy of Joseph Campbell, follow your bliss. And to me, that's, and I'm sure you could speak a lot more to this than I can, but that's what was happening. It was like you were doing that. And the world was saying, the universe was saying, young Stephen, you're on the right path. Or Stevie, as you call yourself. Yeah,
yeah. Well, you know, so I eventually, you know, I went back to New York and I did some research in pediatric endocrinology for a couple of years at Cornell without a PhD, but I was just a research associate. And then I went down to Penn, but I eventually dropped out of a PhD program at Penn in immunology. And I went to the University of Chicago Divinity School, where Moshe Eliade was teaching and writing his book on shamanism, and where Joseph Campbell spent about half the year, because he was mostly in New York, but he spent half the year in Hyde Park. And I had a cup of coffee in the Swift Kick coffee shop with none other than Joseph Campbell and Moshe Eliade. And they were very different. Moshe had all this tuffy hair coming out of his ears, and he was very hunched over, and you could hardly understand him. And he spoke three or four languages, and he just kind of merged them. And Joseph Campbell always had a wonderful tie and a sports jacket on, and he jogged every day. He was a very different kind of guy. And I told them the story of the car on Route 80 and how just as I was going to turn around and go home, the generator broke. And Moshe Eliade and Joseph Campbell both believed together, they said together, that was synchronicity. I mean, I could have responded to it differently. I could have said, okay, so the car stopped. I'm gonna somehow call my dad this morning, and I'm gonna make my way back to New York. And I was supposed to go to Swarthmore. But you know, I thought to myself, you know, This is too profound. I think it's a message not to go back, but to go forward. Okay, the road less traveled. It's a message to go forward. And I've always had that philosophy of life. Like I don't, you know, I taught at Chicago. I you know, Case Western, Stony Brook, all kinds of things, and I've done wonderful stuff with my life. But I feel like I never made my life. I just was on a journey, and I responded to people who I encountered with kindness, with a kind of gentleness. And that's why I'm here right now. This is my office in the medical school, you know, and we win national awards on teaching communication techniques and humanities. But you know, I also run this Institute for Research on Unlimited Love, because one of the guys I met on this journey was Sir John Templeton, the philanthropist. And we saw eye to eye. He had an experience when he was a kid. He went to Yale, and after he finished, the war was just over, he went to Israel, and he was in a friend's house, and Israel was not a state at the time, and they were being surrounded by some hostile parties, and it was a pretty dangerous era. And he thought he was finished, so he kind of snuck out the back way, and his mother, in Franklin County, Tennessee, had a dream that night that John Templeton was in great danger and even dead. And so she took his letters, which she'd collected over the years, and she burned them. And of course, there were no cell phones or anything like that. So when he showed up and he got home, of course, everybody realized they wished they had those letters. But it was a premonition thing for him. And so we talked for hours about this. I mean, I would talk about my mother and the way somehow love can connect people in a way that just blows through the limits of time and place. And there's an energy field about this, and it allows a lot of things to happen that are totally uncanny, but are real in so many people's lives. And so we had that in common.
Yeah, it's really your story really emphasizes that truth that I think this is what's coming to me. It's like that truth tickles everyone. It like mm-hmm. it emerges in everyone's lives in different ways. And some people it's a little nudge, and they kind of push it to the side, and the universe goes, no, 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 let's do something else. Maybe you'll start tapping in. And for other people like you, you just seem to embrace it kind of from day one. And I love that you brought Robert Frost in, because when you were sharing the beginning of your story, in my mind, I actually had this vision. I was like, oh, we have to talk about Robert Frost, because I just saw you up in New Hampshire, out in nature.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That was very much kind of in your, you were channeling some Robert Frost, I feel like.
Well, I love Robert Frost. And the book talk, you know, God Love on Route 80 talks about my childhood on Oak Neck Lane in West Islip. And there were no other kids around. And so I used to take my wagon down to Mr. Muller's house. He was an old guy, retired from Grumman Aeronautics. And he taught me how to do carpentry work in his garage. And we used to burn things in these planks of pine, you know. And we either burned statements from the New Testament or from Robert Frost. And then we varnished them and we nailed them up. He had a big woods next to his house. We put them on the tree. So if you walk through that area, you would see these incredible quotes, you know, something there is that does not love a wall, stuff like that, you know. And so I like Frost a lot. And I used to read a lot of Frost when I was a kid.
So speaking of memories, I really want people to have a insight into this extraordinary book that you wrote, Dignity for Deeply Forgetful People. And this is a recent book of yours, and there's some real tangible like reasons why you brought this into the world. And I'd love for everyone to kind of understand the importance of this book and why you're so compelled for it to be out in the world.
Yeah. Well, you know, I first started getting into neuroscience. I went to grad school at the U of Chicago, which gets as cold as Minneapolis sometimes when that wind comes sweeping in off Lake Michigan.
Oh my goodness.
It really does.
It does. You know? It smacks you.
It does. And I had a chance to study with Sir John Eccles, who was a Nobel Prize laureate. He pretty much discovered everything we know basically about neurotransmission between cells. And he was not a physicalist. He believed in a part of the mind that is not just peripheral or an epiphenomenal thing of brain, tissue, cells, and whatever. He believed there was a non-material aspect of the mind. And he'd had all kinds of interesting experiences in his own life that suggested that to him. So he didn't think that the mind could be reduced. It shouldn't be nothing but matter. He thought the brain was a temple for the mind, that the mind is a treasure in an earthen vessel, he sometimes said, but you shouldn't confuse the vessel with the mind itself. And so we got along really well. My grandmother, she died of what was probably Alzheimer's disease. And I had the opportunity in my late 20s to spend some time with her in a nursing home. And I would do assisted oral feeding. And the thing about it is that, you know, she couldn't remember much. She couldn't communicate much. But when, you know, it would be applesauce and bran things, just the ritual of spoon feeding her, which was not always neat and clean. Sometimes her eyes would light up and sparkle. And I had to be open to surprises, because she might actually, you know, on a given day, say Stevie, you know. And so I always assumed that underneath this loss of communicative capacity, there was still something eternal about her. And that's why I wrote this book with Johns Hopkins. It's done well. Dignity for Deeply Forgetful People. I don't like the word dementia, because dementia is like the word retard. You know, it's like, you know, no one uses that. We don't talk about people as, we may talk about them as differently able, and so forth, but we don't talk about them in negative terms. Dementia means a decline from a former mental state. And so it invites these negative metaphors that you hear in nursing homes all the time, you know, husk, empty, gone, shell. And then politicians, no names to be provided, will refer to their worst political enemies as demented. And so it's a bad label. But and it's also them versus us. Like, they're over there and we're not demented. Okay, so I have my moments. You know, I sometimes have to ask medical students, do you remember where I parked my car? You know? And there was one day I got a little nervous about this. I had to ask a student, do you remember if I drove to work today? That was more serious. It's kind of, but anyway.
I'm sorry. I have to ask, what was the response of that student?
They laughed. They just laughed. They said, I don't know. They just laughed. And I realized, okay, I did drive today and I hit my key and I found my car. But there's a difference. That's worse. It's okay to forget where you parked your car. It's a little more of a problem if you forget where your car, that you have a car that's parked. That's a good sort of diagnostic division. And so you know, but we all know what these experiences are about. They're embarrassing. We can't remember names and so forth. It's just commonplace. And so, deeply forgetful, to be deeply forgetful is more of a statement of continuum, you know, that somehow their experience, although it's intensified and it's more consistent over time, it's not that completely different than things that we all kind of know about. And we need to use our moral imaginations to sort of be open about this. I won't tell too many stories, but
you create safe space though with this book.
That's what it's about. It's about creating a safe space. And also I talk a lot about, Kelly, symbolic rationality. People may not have linear rationality for you Western philosophers, okay? The rationality that gets you from point A to point B with your plans, but you can have symbolic rationality. So I knew a guy in Cleveland who worked in the steel mills named Clint, and even to the day he died, he hung on to his cowboy hat, and he just somehow wouldn't let it go. And even when he took a shower, and then after that we had to wring it out, and I just knew this meant something. It turns out he worked in those factories, and he dressed country and Western. And he somehow knew that his identity was connected with this. And I know a guy named David Keck, whose father, Leander Keck, was a very famous New Testament scholar at Yale. And Janet Keck, David's mother, passed away of Alzheimer's some years ago, and he wrote a book about this. But, you know, she would be incommunicado, but on Sunday mornings, she went to the Yale chapel. And when she heard those familiar hymns from her childhood, when she was reading those familiar prayers,
she just dialed right in.
Dialed right in, and she could speak. She could get lucid, and even after this little, you know, church was over, you know, for like even 5 or 10 minutes, if people use the right kind of language, I mean, yes, no questions are very good. Don't do open-ended stuff. What would you like for breakfast? Say, you know, would you like ham and eggs or, you know, Cheerios? Yeah, you have to provide language for it. But she could converse quite well for 5 to 10 minutes, and then it would fade. But emotionally, she was a lot better off. And the question is, you know, for both of you, Brian, and for all your audience, where's that come from? Is it just some remnant of neurological tissue that brings her back into her who she is, or is it something deeper than that? Is something opaque being revealed or unveiled about? So one of my best buddies, an African-American minister from Cleveland, originally from Detroit. His sister passed away of Alzheimer's a couple of years ago. And we were speaking, he was in Detroit, and we were speaking on the phone, on the cell phone. We had cell phones by that time. And I said, so you've been with her for the last couple of weeks. Where do you think she is? And he said, you know, I think she's one step ahead of us. I think maybe she's gone down to that Amtrak station and she's got one, he's a Baptist, one foot already set on that blessed train for glory.
That is, how do you wrap up an interview then like that? That is, Dr. Post, thank you so much. Like, I feel like we could go on and on and on and on. You guys, StephenGPost.com. Lots of books. We just scratched the surface. This has been a complete honor. Brian, anything else you want to share?
I would just say, you know, thank you for your storytelling. Yeah. Thank you for your kindness and openness. And I really hope that people feel that energetically, take some action, go to Stephen's website, stephengpost.com. He will respond. His info is right there. Send him a note. Ask him a question. Let's keep this conversation going.
That's
a PH in Stephen, yes.
Beautiful.
Thank you, Dr. Post. This is the Being Curious Show. Let's have the conversation continue. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you both. Pleasure.